Now, adjust the volume control so that the sound can be heard in all parts of the room.
This is the Protect Your Assets podcast. Mr.
Sandman, you get the idea? Bring me a
dream. It's on the internet. Cutest that
I've ever seen. Go on. Give him two
lips like roses. It's a great program. And tell him
that it's lonesome nights. Here's the Sandman.
All right. My guest today is Matt Hall. Matt is the co-founder and partner at Hill Investment Group in St. Louis. He is the author of Odds On, the Making of an Evidence-Based Investor, and hosts the award-winning podcast, now in season 3, titled Take the Long View. In 21, Matt was recognized with the prestigious Think Advisor Luminary Award for Thought Leadership in Education. And Matt happens to be a good friend of mine. So welcome to Protect Your Assets, Matt. Thanks for coming.
I'm glad to be here.
It's quite a lot going on in the world today. It never ceases to be dull in 2022. So listen, I was looking over some background, and we were talking about something called this paradox. And I'm curious to find out more about what that means and if it's something that can help us now in this crazy, the Stockdale paradox. And to find out more about that, if it's something that could help our listeners in this sort of tumultuous time that's going on in Ukraine and Russia right now.
Yeah, it's interesting because I did an episode on the Stockdale paradox, I think 2.5 years ago, or whenever the beginning of the pandemic happened. But sure. I've been interested in this idea ever since I read about it in the classic business book, Good to Great, where Jim Collins wrote about Admiral Jim Stockdale and his attitude that helped him survive being a military prisoner. He and I think John McCain were in the same prison camp, and Stockdale was tortured over 20 times. And when Jim Collins asked him how he was able to survive, he described his outlook and his approach, and in doing so, he also talked about the people who did not make it out. And I'll sort of cut to the chase. The people who did not make it out were the people he termed the optimists. And what he meant by that was the people who said, I'm going to make it out by Christmas. I'm going to make it out by Easter. I'm going to make it out by Thanksgiving. And then when those arbitrary deadlines didn't come or didn't happen, they died of a broken heart. So what he said is he decided that his outcome was certain. I am getting out, and this will be a transformational experience in my life, surviving this experience. But I don't know when I'm getting out, and I'm not going to lock in on milestone dates. I'm locking in on the certainty that I will get out and I will turn this dreadful experience into a transformational part of my life. But I also accept my day-to-day reality. And so that attitude of like long-term certainty, short-term reality, we have used many times in our own firm and how we coach the people we work with, and even how we deal with uncertainty ourselves. And that's a big part of the philosophy of my life and my podcast and my organization. I love that approach. And it's, I think it's a way to deal with, whatever the apocalypse du jour is.
Got it. Makes sense. All right. So another one, most people think of money when they think of wealth, but you have a different expanded definition of wealth. Talk about being a time millionaire or billionaire.
Yeah, so I didn't create this concept. I think the guy who came up with it or who's made it more popular is named Graham Duncan. He was on a podcast that Tim Ferriss does. And he talked about this notion of someone who's in their 30s has a billion seconds left in their life. So they're a time billionaire. When you think about it for a second, if you're say in your 80s and you were an actual money billionaire, what would you give to have 10 years? If you could buy 10 years back, 10 healthy years, what would you give?
Yeah.
And so this idea is, if you're 30 and you have time, how do you really appropriately value that resource? Because there are other people in the world who would value it very differently than you would. They would pay a lot for 10 years of healthy living. And oftentimes, you know, in our 30s, maybe we're dreaming of the financial freedom. But later, at a different time in our life, we're valuing, time and health freedom with a different multiple. So I would say, you know, that idea of a time billionaire, I think, is a way for people to prioritize time in a different way. You know, you really need the trifecta to have it all. You need time, health, and money.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes there's such a focus on money, we forget about the other two. And you probably have stories too from your own experience. But in my experience, I've met plenty of people who have worked their whole lives to have money freedom, only to have the other two sort of fall away. And, you know, if you have all three, you're really living a very rich life. And so anyway, I like that concept because it sort of helps you think about time differently and reprioritize it maybe.
Yeah, and thinking and talking about stories, you know, I've heard about this story about 20 years ago in Las Vegas and how that helped you or impacted your life, I guess, quite deeply. So, I haven't heard this story, so I'm interested in hearing about it and how it affected you.
So, first of all, Las Vegas of all places to like have a kind of life changing thing happen. You know, it seems sort of funny, but. Going back many years ago, I'm 48 years old now, and I was in my early 20s at the time. I had dropped out of law school, and I was really struggling to figure out, like, what am I going to do with my life? And my girlfriend at the time, now wife, said, hey, let's go out to Las Vegas for a weekend and meet some friends and family who are going to be out there. And let's just have a good time. Don't worry about, you know, planning your future. Let's just go. And it was around the time of March Madness. So it was in the springtime. And so we went out there. And while we were out there, my girlfriend said, hey, a couple from St. Louis is actually here in Las Vegas. And I want to meet up with them for dinner. And I said, oh, my gosh, are you kidding me? Why would we go to dinner with people who are from our same town? Well, we can do that anytime when we're back at home. We're here in Las Vegas. I'm betting on these basketball games with these friends of ours we came out here to see. I don't really feel like doing a meet and greet right now. She was like, nope, you're going to go up, take a shower, get dressed, and you're going to go to this dinner. I'm not exactly sure why she was so insistent on this, but I did it. I went upstairs, took a shower, got dressed, came down. We went to this dinner. And at the dinner, the husband and I started talking. And of course, I was kind of embarrassed by, you know, my fledgling career choices. And I knew he was going to ask me, so Matt, what are you doing?
Yeah.
So I turned it back to him. I was like, I'm more curious about what you're up to. He's like, well, I have joined an investment firm and one of my partners wrote a book. And I was like, oh, really? What's the book about? He started telling me about it. And he said, when you get back to St. Louis, I'll send you a copy. And I remember thinking, oh, my gosh, I haven't read an investment book in my entire life. I doubt I'm going to read this thing, but you know, who knows? This guy was very nice and we had a pleasant dinner and that was that. We went back to our sort of, gambling and having a good time and going out to nice dinners. And when I got back, I got a copy of the book he mentioned, and the first 100 pages of this book totally changed my life.
Huh.
Because the book, and the title of the book was, is called The Only Guide to a Winning Investment Strategy You Will Ever Need.
Hmm.
Now, here I am. I'm 48 now, and this happened when I was in my early 20s. I just today at lunch gave a copy of this same book to a young person who's trying to figure out what he's going to do with his life.
Huh.
I wouldn't tell you it's the best book ever written, but it changed my life because the author did a magnificent job of sort of unveiling or uncovering the truth about successful investing. And, we could get into the details of what the book actually talks about, but I would say it changed my life because my parents were both educators and I was always wrestling with, you know, when at the dinner table, they didn't talk about clients, they talked about students, and they didn't talk about a P&L, they talked about curriculum. So I was always interested in how could I figure out a way to merge an educational career with commerce, with business. And, you know, the essence of this book was it talked about a quantitative sort of rules-based, evidence-based approach to investing that turned what I knew of like sort of Wall Street on its head. And I just loved it. And so I thought, if I could get a job with this firm, so the guy that I met who gave me this book, I'm now going to harass him until I can get a job at this firm because his partner wrote this book. Mm-hmm. And this company is in my hometown. And so that changed my life because I harassed these people until they hired me. they didn't really have any openings at the time. And I just said, trust me, I'll work for free. I get you. I'm picking up what you're putting down. Let me in. Huh. And thankfully, they did not take me up on the work for free part, but it really did change my life. And it was the start of my career.
Interesting. Well, you know, thinking about that, we have demographics across the board, all different age groups. One thing we've talked a little bit about is connecting with your future self. How do you recommend doing that, not just when it comes to financial decisions, but also your life? Like, we talked a little about the paradox. It's an interesting one if you're in a hard time. But how about things are going relatively well and you're thinking about your future? I mean, talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so there's research that has been done by Hal Hirschfield, Professor Hal Hirschfield, who I think is out of UCLA. And he talks a lot about this idea of your future self. And the idea essentially is this: the clearer your future self can be to you, the more vivid your future self is to you, the more likely you are to plan and prepare for that future version of yourself. So to get connected with this distant you will help you take action today. And, you know, behavioral finance people are working hard always to figure out how can I help people make better decisions today for their sort of their future self. And so here's one exercise that people have done. I have not done this myself, but you could write a letter to your future self. Now, writing a letter, and there are great apps and tools online that allow you to do this, and they'll actually send it back to you whatever date you instructed to kick it back to you. So it's kind of like putting that putting the letter in the bottle and throwing it out in the ocean, and then giving it some direction to help it come back. That's one way people have done it. There's also technology that allows you to visualize yourself. You know, it can show you what the 80-year-old Hollander would look like. but the idea is, and Hirschfield's idea is the more vivid the picture we have of our future selves, the more we can make decisions on our future selves' behalf. So, you know, those are a few of the ways that I think people can do it, is like write the letter, use technology to create a vision, but you can also just start planning, because the more you start planning, the more you're imagining what things can look like down the road. I'll give you one quick example. My wife and I just had a meeting. We have a meeting as a client ourselves at my own firm. And so we have to like come in the front door together, and you know, we have the full experience. And when we were talking about goals and our financial purpose and all this stuff, my wife said, you know, I really would like to have a place that in Southern California that we can go to where I can visit my sister and we can spend more time there. And I could tell, even as she was talking about it, she was imagining herself there. She was seeing herself walking on the Strand. She was seeing herself having coffee. She was imagining herself meeting up with her sister. And you could tell, even if unintentionally, she was creating a clearer, more vivid picture of her future self by stating this goal and putting it into our planning. And so that was a lot of fun. So that's the idea. And, you know, these are all just ways to like sort of hack or outsmart our wiring, because we tend to live day to day and not sometimes by nature think and plan for the distant future.
Exactly. That's a constant battle. And so talking about that, I know you started your podcast, The Long View, and congratulations. I know it's been a lot of fun for you. You can tell you're enjoying it. How'd you come up with that name, and why is that relevant to what you're doing?
Yeah. So I'm obsessed with take the long view, that expression. So it's not just the name of my podcast. It's actually the mantra of my firm. And if I could turn this video camera around and show you in my office, it's nailed to the wall. Like when you walk in the office, there's huge brass letters that say, take the long view, even more prominently displayed than the name of our actual firm. Mm-hmm. We end every email with the same expression, take the long view. We say it when we see and interact with people. I see people in the grocery store and they'll say, oh, Matt, did you see what's happening in the world today? They're like, yeah, never mind. I'm taking the long view. Forget it. But what it really means is it's a different lens and a different perspective and a wider gaze. You know, I said this expression earlier that this idea of like ignoring the apocalypse of the day or the apocalypse du jour. When you have a longer view or a wider gaze, I think it's a healthier, more profitable also outlook to have. And so I spend a lot of time thinking about how to help people get above or away from the noise. My podcast is really about helping people embrace patience and discipline. Those happen to be also necessary ingredients, I think, for long-term successful investors. So I love it because it's a great mantra for our firm and our people. I'll give you a real life example. In my book, in Odds On, I have a friend who he became a client, and prior to working with us, he was one of these people who I would say was highly attached to things that were happening in the world and in the markets. And so as part of our process, I was trying to help him see that the North Star, the sort of place we were going to go together, was a place where he was detached from sort of the daily gyrations. And he pulled up his phone to me and was like, hey, listen, look at this map. And he showed me his stocks app and there was nothing in there. It was empty. And that was his way of saying, I got rid of all that stuff. That stuff that used to affect me, that I used to live and die by, it's gone. Now, he's still an investor. He still owns things, but he's not going to use the movements in the world to dictate his mood of the day. The big payoff there, though, is not just like how it impacts him, but it compounds because it affects other relationships. It affected him as a dad and a husband and a as a worker. So it starts that kind of thing. The payoff starts to compound in other really meaningful ways too. And for me, I think that's what the long view does. Actually, if you take that bigger, broader, wider gaze and get yourself out of the noise, you get back some time and energy that gets redeployed in other places, probably in a healthier and ultimately a more profitable way.
How would you on your website, you talk about Anheuser-Busch, and I'm sure it sounds like this philosophy is somewhat ingrained in your staff, I would imagine. So, talk to us a little bit about that. How did that inspire you? How do you think you motivate your staff to live away like that, as opposed to headhunter of the day knocking on your door, trying to poach your people? Like, how do you deal with that?
Yeah. Okay. So first, the Anheuser-Busch part, I would just say, I live in St. Louis, and even though Anheuser-Busch is different from how it used to be, it got acquired in 2008 by a company called InBev, and it changed a little bit. But as a St. Louisan, you can't live here and not be proud of Anheuser-Busch. And the closer you get to it and the more you investigate the history and you investigate their attention to detail and their standard for excellence. Yes, I like micro brews too. I know micro breweries and these sort of, interesting sort of craft beers are very, very popular. But I would just tell you that this company's history and their attention to detail and their standard for excellence, it is truly inspiring. I'll also tell you that back in the 80s, they changed the way they invest, the way their 401k plan and their pension plan invested to be very similar to the way you and I like to do things. So there's tons of history and connection here, but my business partner also, he came to St. Louis from Delaware, and eventually was the assistant treasurer at Anheuser-Busch. We met while working at another investment firm, but, because of my relationship with him, we ended up working with a fair number of former Anheuser-Busch executives and distributors. And so I know a lot more than I probably otherwise would know about the beer culture that was attached to the place.
Sure.
And I mean, you know, I know there are other companies that say this too, but they hold themselves to a standard that really has no competitor. Mm-hmm. I mean, both with ingredients and here's an example. They have, even still to this day, they have an international brewmaster competition where these people are tasting beers for off flavors at a level of like detail that a normal person cannot taste or acknowledge.
Sure.
They care so deeply about consistency and excellence. And it just, I find it inspiring as a business person, but also, you know, they have an iconic brand, they have incredible commercials, and they really, for many, many years, were a source of community pride here too in our region. So the question then came from my own firm, like, what are the, you know, sort of cultural cornerstones of our own firm? What are the things we care deeply about? What are the things we're proud of? What are the things that energize our team to be together, and to, what are the things we would say we can hold out as like having no peer, or that are, where we operate at a very high level also. So it's just Anheuser-Busch has served as a inspiration. Now they're not perfect, like any organization, they have their own issues, but I would just say I find it fascinating to learn from other companies, and especially ones where I took our entire team on a tour. It was a 3-hour tour, which, I mean, that's, I'm sorry, but that's a long tour for anything.
It's a long time.
I wanted to know that much about beer, but I really enjoyed it. And by the way, we weren't drinking beer the whole time. We didn't get to drink beer until like 2 hours, 30 minutes into this thing.
Gotcha.
So anyway, it's a real source of pride here. And we find it inspiring. Also, one other thing I'll tell you about them is back in the old days, their mantra was not like mine was take the long view. Their mantra back in the old days was making friends is our business. Hmm. Because they believed that beer was about relationships and celebration, and that, you know, they weren't necessarily in the beer business as much as they were in the making friends and developing relationships and celebrating. And so I thought that was interesting as well.
Do you know anything about the Budweiser out of Prague?
No.
Yeah. I was back there a few years ago and I tried a Budweiser there, and I was told how it was completely different. And it was really interesting though. Same name, similar logos and so forth, but completely different. So I don't know how they cropped out of each other.
Well, you know, Eberhard Anheuser and Augustus Busch, I think, were the, you know, the people who created Anheuser-Busch in America. Also, another thing to think about is like what businesses can survive. I think it was 16-year period. Was it 16 or 13? I don't know. A period of prohibition.
Right.
I mean, if your main product got shut down, how many businesses can survive for that long?
Right.
Or pivot, as they say now, to something else. I mean, that's no small thing.
Especially for the size of that kind of company.
Yeah.
So you were profiled in Laura Vanderkam's, did I say that right? Vanderkam?
Yeah.
Vanderkam's book, What the Most Successful People Do at Work, in her chapter on knowing what is work. You don't view activity and value as connected in the workplace. So just because someone's busy, that doesn't mean they're doing what matters. How have you built this mindset into your company's culture?
Yeah. So the question of activity and value, you know, sometimes when there's unrest in the world, like there is right now, people want you to act. Like, don't just stand there, do something. And sometimes doing something maybe counterproductive. And even though it might feel good to do something. So I hate to even use this example, but there's something that happens in the world and someone calls an investment person and says, sell it all. You know, there are so many things that happen that have no long-term impact on your actual investment plans that we for a long time have said activity and value are not necessarily related. So what are the activities that do provide value? Well, you can do tax loss harvesting. You could take advantage of tax management opportunities that exist all throughout the year. That's something you could do. You could rebalance, which is effectively as close as someone like us gets to market timing, where you're selling what's done well and buying what's done poorly. You could do that, but you're not going to do the sort of erratic, emotional, crazy frenzied reaction that might feel good in the short run. So as from an investment perspective, activity doesn't always equal value. And that's something we believe as a firm. But even within my own firm, I would say our sort of operating system, and people probably in your area may be somewhat familiar with this because it's come, it's really popular in Silicon Valley, is this OKR framework, objectives and key results. So we manage our firm by, you know, everyone, including myself, has an objective. And then that objective can be measured by what progress? What is the key result? Mm-hmm. And so that's a way that we have a dashboard or a scoreboard where every single person here can see the other people's objectives and their key results. And we use a simple sort of green, yellow, and red light structure to tell you visually, like, hey, here, I'm on track. I might need some help, or this is in danger. If it's red, that means, hey, Hollander, come over here because I need your help.
Yeah.
If it's yellow, it could just say, like, I'm working on it, but there's a question mark as to whether we're going to get there or not. So every quarter, we do new objectives and key results. And that's a great way, at least from my point of view, to make sure the activities that we're working on are actually the ones that matter. Because guess what? If your objectives tie together, if they all connect up to the goals and the vision of the firm, then it's really exciting because you really feel like, even if you're working remotely, as many of us have been in the last few years, you feel like in lockstep with your colleagues, because you know, oh, I see that this person's working on that thing because this category's objective or target is that. And here's how my contribution fits in there. Or they may need my help. I'm really cruising along with my objectives and key results, and I can connect to theirs and help them out. So it's really, I find that to be a highly useful framework for managing a team or an organization. It creates a lot of clarity. And ultimately, I think that's what we all at some level crave, is our decisions get a lot easier when our vision is really clear.
Sure. So, is that software or what is that? How do you do that?
So this guy who I think has a St. Louis connection named John Doerr wrote a book all about OKRs. It's called Measure What Matters. And yeah. So we read that book a few years back and then sort of started tinkering with the idea of how we could execute on it. Microsoft has a tool that we use and some people use. Another tool called Asana has an OKR sort of framework or tracking ability. But ultimately, the real work comes down to, you know, individuals and leadership deciding, hey, what does the firm care about? What matters to us? Like, what are your business development goals? What are your service goals? What are your planning objectives? And then how are you going to measure progress towards those targets?
Makes sense.
So it sounds obvious. It's hard to actually get good at it. It took us over a year to really refine what we were doing and operate in a clear and connected way, but I think we're there now.
Good. Well, especially if you're seeing results, right? That's what matters.
Yeah.
I know you're a big reader. Any books on the radar right now you want to share with us?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I did just read this book that my family is tired of hearing about. It's called Breath. And it's written by the author's name is James Nestor. I think I read some of his stuff in Outside Magazine. And then somehow I heard about this book coming out, and it's about how we breathe and the way in which we breathe does have a big impact on our overall health, more than we've understood in the past. So breath really caught my attention. I'll give you the punchline if you really want it. Better breathe through your nose. Better breathe through your nose.
All the time. Exhale through your mouth, right?
Wow. Bad things happen when you breathe through your mouth over a long period of time. Another book that I am really into and I've given out a lot is called The Optimist. And it's written by a guy named David Coggins. And he's written books on etiquette and fashion, but this is actually a book on fly fishing.
Oh.
And I kind of got into fly fishing recently, not necessarily because I'm so into the fishing part as much as I am into spending time in nature. I think spending time in nature is really important and it connects you to a larger purpose. His book is about a series of trips he took, fly fishing trips he took, and the impact those trips had on him. But I actually had him on my podcast, and he used the expression "take the long view" in his book. No. So if you're going to say take the long view all throughout your book, I got to have you on my podcast and we got to talk about if you used it properly or not. Well, he sure did use it properly. He's a great writer. And when I've given people this book, I'll tell you, a lot of people then want to book a trip to Patagonia because he does such a great job of, in one of his trips, he talks about his Patagonia fly fishing experience and it's really inspiring. So those are Breath and The Optimist are two books I've been kind of into in the last little bit.
Nice. Thank you. And how would people find out more about you?
So the thing I think that's probably the most interesting is the podcast I do, Take the Long View. That's pretty cool. You can find that wherever you listen to podcasts. I wrote a book called Odds On. You can find that on Amazon. I'm really proud of it. It's been transformational in my life, I got to tell you. I mean, I've talked to people from the Netherlands to North Dakota because of this book. It got converted to Dutch. I have no idea why really, but it did. The firm where I practice what I preach is called Hill Investment Group. And, on the internets where you would normally find people. My name is pretty common. So Matt Hall and any of those things like Odds On or Take the Long View, you'll find me.
Well, hey, I really appreciate you taking the time today and talking to our listeners. It was a lot of fun to hang out with you and spend some time.
Yeah, great talking with you, and I hope this is interesting for your listeners. Can't wait till you and I can hang out together again.
Investment advisory services are offered through Liberty Wealth Management, a registered investment advisor. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. The strategies mentioned are not suitable for everyone. The information expressed does not consider your specific situation or objectives and may not be appropriate for all investors. Past performance is not indicative of future results. To better understand the risk associated with investing and how it reacts to different market conditions, listeners should always consult with their qualified investment professionals, financial advisors, legal or tax specialists, and conduct their due diligence before making any financial decisions or taking any action. The legal information provided on the air is not intended to substitute for callers hiring their lawyers to advise them about personal legal matters. Investments involve risk and, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Liberty Group LLC paid for the following program, and the host's views and opinions do not represent those of the station or its ownership. California Life Agent number 048569. Persons engaging the services of one affiliate of Liberty Group LLC companies should be aware that each company is operated separately. You're listening to the Protect Your Assets Radio Network.